Welcome to another episode of Burning the Ships. I'm your host, Jason Seward, and we're going to get things kicked off today like we've been doing recently with JJ's Joke of the Week. So as I've mentioned in previous episodes, this is something that I promised him I would start doing at the beginning of every podcast. It has nothing to do with the interviews or the topics, but a fun way that he can be involved a little bit. So he gave me one for this week. As I always say, he claims he's making these up. I do not believe it. I think he's looking them up and then sharing. Not that I'm calling my son a liar, but I do not believe he's making these up. He may be, but here's what he's got today. Why are skeletons so calm? Because nothing gets under their skin. And that's JJ's joke of the week. So now we're going to get into the episode. Today, I have Jennifer Stewart. A lot of you listening, if you're on social media and you're involved with real estate, you've no doubt come across Jennifer's content on social media. She's very active there at promoting what she does in real estate, which is quite a bit, and we'll get into all that in the episode. But I'm going to go ahead and tell you a little bit about Jennifer, and then we will get going with the interview. So today we are diving into the world of off-market real estate acquisitions with a powerhouse in the industry, Jennifer Stewart. With 9 years of expertise in sourcing and securing off-market deals, Jennifer has built an empire, running an agency of 180 virtual assistants who engage directly with sellers, pull critical data, and skip trace an astonishing 2 million records per month. As a full-time commercial real estate broker under EXP Commercial's referral division and a certified expert through the National Commercial Real Estate Association, Jennifer brings unparalleled market knowledge and strategic insight to every deal. She's not just in the game, she's shaping it. Speaking at top real estate investing events nationwide, educating investors on acquisitions, market trends, and investment strategies. What's Jennifer's mission? To empower investors with innovative solutions that drive both short-term wins and long-term financial success. Whether you're looking to break into real estate or scale your portfolio, her expertise is exactly what you need. Get ready to burn the ships and go all in. Let's welcome Jennifer Stewart to the show. Jennifer Stewart, welcome to Burning the Ships. Glad to have you.
Thank you, Jason. It's great to be here first thing on a Monday for me. Yeah. And wow, how was your weekend?
Awesome. We traveled. I'm in Virginia, so we traveled down to North Carolina. My son wrestles, so we had to go to a wrestling tournament down there. And fortunately, all the snow and cold weather has kind of gotten out of here, so it wasn't too bad.
Yeah. How'd he do?
He's 8 years old, and he is the size of most five-year-olds. He's a very tiny kid, which I was when I was his age also. So he's always having to wrestle up, you know, wrestle up a weight class. Yeah. He's tough. He fights hard, but he did not do too well from a winning-loss standpoint.
I think that'll build character. You know, my youngest son is like that too, Jason. He is the size like your son, and then my older son is the opposite. He's always been in that top 2 to top half percentile height, and my other son is on the opposite end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
And so to see how they navigate life differently, and so therefore I have to somewhat parent them a little bit differently, I know what that's like.
Yeah. So he's funny because his 8-year-old brain, like he hasn't started to comprehend that he's like smaller than everybody else. And that's a disadvantage. And when we say things to him like, JJ, you got to eat, you know, we're growing, buddy. We got to get bigger. I like being small. I'm better at hide and seek. You know, that's his logic, you know, so, but
it's so cute.
It's funny. So Jennifer, your last name, I'll share this with you. I've spent my entire life watching people spell my name with a T. Put a T after the S.
I bet.
Every time I say my name and they write it down, and or like if I'm ordering something, it always gets shipped with a T where the S should be. So it's fine. Yeah.
Well, whenever I think of Seward, I think of Seward, Alaska,
Alaska. Yep.
Which is a place that I have been. And so for me, it sticks as like Seward, Alaska. And I have not obviously been a steward my whole life. I became one at 25 years old. So it was an adjustment to, you know, think of myself as Jennifer Stewart. And so, yeah, I can totally see, especially someone who hadn't been to Alaska. You know,
yeah.
Seward. Well, that must be a typo. Let's put in a T. It's like, no.
And it's actually funny hearing my kids hear me and my wife do this constantly where we say, I'm Jason Seward, S-E-W. I spell it out. So now even my 8-year-olds, I'm J.J. Seward, S-E-W. You know, he spells it out for everybody. So it's funny.
And they put a T at the end of my name. I can't tell
you.
Yeah,
I get that too.
The time. They'll put a T at the end of, I'm like, it's D. D, like dog at the end.
But Jen, I appreciate you joining us. I've been following you on social media for quite some time. You're very connected with a lot of folks in my area in Virginia. And you do a fantastic job, which, you know, we kind of talked about it before we started recording. But, you know, building your brand and letting people know what you do and what you're about. And that, you know, I think through that, you're doing, you know, whether you're intending to or not, but you're doing a great job building an audience of people that get to know, like, and trust you, and then ultimately build your business that way. So I can appreciate that. We've certainly in the last couple of years been trying to do the same things as we've left corporate America, and now we're trying to build a brand around our business and this podcast. So that's how I've kind of gotten to know you from afar. But the thing that I'm most excited about, and I love these types of interviews, is that's about all I know about you, is what I see online. So it's always a treat to get a guest on here that I get to learn in real time your story along with everybody listening. So that's what we're going to do today. And Jennifer, you're north of Dallas.
Yes, I'm about an hour north of Dallas. That's where I homestead.
So why don't we get things kicked off where, and you can go wherever you want with this, but tell folks who you are, kind of run through your story, and then I'm going to have a bunch of questions behind that, you know, as we go. So,
okay. Well, I grew up in a little town called Crandall, Texas, and I moved to McKinney, Texas when I was about 14. I moved in with my dad and my stepmom. The goal was to have the ability to go to college, which my dad was in better position to do than my mother, because my mother had been raising, you know, 4 children on her own, and my dad had been pursuing his career relatively child-free. And that really made it so he could build a lot of momentum. And even though I was loath to leave my mother, I was thinking towards the future, even at that young age, how I needed to have the ability to go to college and have some possibility of leaving poverty. I'd grown up in pretty abject poverty. You know, there were food stamps being sold for drugs and things of that nature. And I knew that I did not want that. The men in the family were on that side, were kind of in and out of prison for meth and things like that. And I just knew that I wanted as far away from that as possible. Nobody expects anything of, especially, I would say, a female from that environment to do well in life. You know, you're expected to have more baby daddies than you do teeth by about 30 years old.
Right.
And so I had to really kind of push against all of the mental junk that comes along with that kind of background. And so, and moving in with my dad, I was a pretty rough character. You know, I mean, you can imagine having, you know, being a child in that kind of environment. And so from there, I read this book whenever I was 15. You guys have heard of it. It was the year 2000. I read a book called Rich Dad, Poor Dad, because I felt like there was something disparate and very inequitable about the system, right? Just going to school all day, and then I was going to go to college, and then I was going to get a job, and then I was going to work that job all day, and I was going to have debt, and but, you know, gosh darn it, people were going to like me because I had done everything I was supposed to do. But then I realized that all that was a joke. I mean, even at 15, I knew it was a joke. And, you know, the 9/11 happened.
Can I pause you for a second? This is a curious question. A ton of people reference that book. I do too. That was a pivotal book for me. I've yet to hear somebody that young be impacted by it. So who, number one, where did you find that book? What led you to that book? And that's not normal, from what I'm typical used to hearing.
Yeah, I
Most
would
people
mention
find that
the
book in their
person.
20s, 30s,
I would mention the person, but he ended up going to prison for white collar crime. And so I don't,
Understand.
it was quite the national case.
Yeah.
But he was precociously brilliant himself. He was 18 and he went on to, I don't think he did what he did on purpose. He was kind of middleman. He was brokering Bitcoin back before Bitcoin was really a thing. And then people paid him, and then I don't think he was able to deliver. But I know, I mean, I don't think he did that in a way that was intentional, even though I haven't spoken to him since the year 2000. Who knows? Maybe people change, but the person that I knew wouldn't have done something like that. But anyways, he was reading this book, and I was talking to him because we love to talk about business, even at, age 15 and 18.
Crazy. Yeah.
And he was reading this book, and I said, "What book are you reading?" And he said, "I'm reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad." And it'll kind of outline for you all the things that we've talked about, how everything is all the system is complete BS, and it's meant to set you up to make other people profitable. And I just knew I didn't want to be leveraged. I guess especially growing up the way I grew up, it was like you just lose all mystique of life at a young age whenever there's violence and hunger and I'm having to steal to feed my little brother. I'll never be able to eat bologna again because I would put bologna in my pants and bread in my coat and try to get as much as I could just to feed my little brother. And so there was no coddling. There was no, oh, if I do the way things the way people tell me to, life will go well. I realized at a very young age I had to create my own rules in order to survive. And I would have worked for that bread and bologna, but that would have embarrassed my family members and I would have been spanked for that. Or beaten. So, I didn't want to steal. It felt very wrong. But then the owner of that store kind of saw and looked the other way because he knew small town people knew. So it was kind of like, they knew I never stole candy. I never stole stuff that I didn't need. It was only what I needed. And so, you just realize that there's so much more to life than what most people are shown. And so I felt like that had set me up for that. So I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur at 15 years old. And in fact, my husband, who's just in the next room, he could tell you, he remembers me sitting there reading Cashflow Quadrant at age 16, because that's whenever we met. And I was an employee at the time. And I was like, we've got to move. We've got to move around the quadrant. And his mother, my mother-in-law, she just couldn't believe that I was reading these kind of books at
Right.
16.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Between customers. And so I was exposed at a young age, and I did my best to start my own businesses. But without the advent of the internet, it was much more difficult to get the information you needed. It was much more difficult to leverage the workforce that I do now, thanks to the internet and thanks to instant communications overseas. In the past, in my dad's generation, to leverage 180 people in the Philippines like I do now, I would have had to have traveled there, which would have been dangerous and hot and, how, and then how, and then I'd have to have a manager over there, and the logistics of it alone would be cost prohibitive. And the internet has made it much, much, much more possible to start a business where you can really have an amazing workforce at a good price and build an audience like we talked about and be the bank. And so my progress from 16 to 35 was unfortunately a little slow because I didn't know how to move on the chessboard. As you know, those books really don't get into specifics.
Right.
And so I'm really big on specifics, Jason. If you,
Yeah.
like I said, you can't take action on it, I don't want to hear your fluff.
Well, that and you're bringing up a good point because that we see that a lot. I'm in several different masterminds and mentor a handful of folks that are getting started out in real estate and stuff like that. And I'd say the most common thing that I see is what you're talking about. They think reading the books, having the mentor, and listening to the podcast, watching the YouTube videos is just going to make things happen. None of that makes anything happen. It sparks ideas. It can motivate action, but you have to apply action, right? And that's what I think a lot of folks get lost, because I see people join these groups and they just think by osmosis they're going to be a millionaire. Well, freaking, it's not going to happen that way, right? So it does take, and I'm guilty of that too when I was younger, just thinking like being around the right people certainly helps.
It helps a lot.
Yeah, it's not going to actually ultimately make the things happen. You got to take action. So, and I do, you know, I want to get into the details of your business a little bit later, but keep talking through that. Like what you said from like 16 to 35, there's a big gap there.
There wasn't a whole lot going on because I didn't know which levers to pull.
Yeah,
I didn't know really how to quite move the needle. So I worked in a bar, which was the closest I could come to freedom from schedule at age 18 on. So I worked in a bar from like 18 to 24, making anywhere from 300 to 1,000 a day, which double that in today's dollars, because we're talking about early 2000s. And I didn't know what to do with that money. I didn't have the friends that I have now and know what funds to put that money into. I didn't know LPs like yourself to say, hey, Jason, I've got an extra 100,000. What can you do with it? And I didn't just want to put it in a stock market that I didn't fully understand. I mean, I put a little bit of it in a stock market. And so really, I just kind of blew that money like young folks are wont to do on traveling. And you know, I put myself through college, and which was good. And but I didn't know how to set myself free. Like if I could take that same amount of money with the same amount of responsibility and the low overhead I had, my bills were $1,500 a month in 2008. And yet I was making, you know, I don't know, maybe 12 grand a month at 22 years old. I kept my overhead low, like cash flow quadrant and like the game cash flow teaches us. But I didn't really know what to do with that money. And then the recession hit. At the same time, my now husband and I produced our first child. So then I was home, and we slowly went through all those savings that I had built up. As I was a mother, and I didn't know how to invest it, and I didn't know where to go or how to learn about it. Not the specifics, right? I knew the general concept of how I wanted to be financially free, but I didn't know what places to put my money. So we all know the path is get a steady income, keep your overhead as low as possible, increase your income, and then save, you know, 6 to 12 months worth of savings. And then from there, start putting your money into equity positions. So I only got as far as saving like a good girl, but I didn't know how to move it into equity positions. And now I do.
Right.
So what I'm trying to do, and what I feel like I've successfully done, is teach my children how you start with equity positions. So stay living with your parents is what I taught my children. Stay living with your parents until your passive income pays your bills to move out and buy a house if you want, or rent. It doesn't matter, because it's your equity position paying for it. In terms of where you live, you can rent, you can own. And it's important to own to keep your cost of living down. But maybe at 21 years old, you don't know where you want to live, right? And so, you know, maybe it's not an area where the numbers make sense on a rental. All the places where most of us want to live, you may have negative cash flow on a rental, you know, on a market. So, you know, renting is okay as long as your equity positions are paying for it. So that's what I've tried to teach them, is like, hey, if you do what mommy teaches you to do, you can be financially free by the time you are 22 years old. And I mean, what a great place to be. But I didn't have that advantage. I didn't have that teaching. And that's okay. You know, that's okay. We have to start where we are. We have to live the life that we have been given. And I feel like now my son's problems is going to be unlike mine. You know, how do we move to financial freedom? It's going to be, well, how do I keep my life meaningful?
Yeah.
Now that we have found financial freedom at such a young age in their case.
Right.
And that's where you have second generation money problems. Like, you know, had to stay off drugs.
Yeah.
Stay away from women you can purchase. You know, stay away from gold diggers. You know, don't let yourself fall into depression. Keep yourself useful, right? That's not a problem you and I have. We are behooved to be useful all day, every day. But I feel like second generation money, they struggle with finding usefulness. And third generation.
You're setting up a good question that I like to ask on, you know, a lot of my guests that maybe came from humble beginnings like yourself. I'm obviously a male, so it's a little bit different for me, but I had, you know, my father was in and out of jail. My mom was, he was a great guy, but he got hung up in some bad things with drugs and stuff like that. And that just took him down a bad path at about the age of 8 for me, 8 to 10. And then forever on after that. But my mom raised me and my two siblings by herself. Poor as dirt. Like, we had nothing, right? But I look back, and when we got through that, my mom, fantastic job. She ended up remarrying when I got in college. She's as happy as she could be now. But during that time period, with as little as we had, the lessons she taught me about just grit and adversity and resilience and, like, this is happening for us. We're all going to be better for it. And so, I mean, she just beat that in our heads. So that has grown me into an adult that I have a lot of appreciation for really little things in life. And I don't waste things. I don't waste time. I don't waste relationships, things like that. So
for you.
I'm setting up a question here because you went through a similar thing. You came from the humble beginnings. You learned a lot of hard lessons just by being around hard environments, and things were very difficult. I would imagine, looking back at where you're at right now, you look back on that and say, that shaped me into a pretty badass individual. So how do you wrestle with this idea of, like, sounds like your kids are very similar to mine, where they have their adversity is running out of what they want for breakfast, right? Like, it's not, we don't have pancakes, so now we got to eat a muffin. The day's horrible, you know? Like, how do you wrestle with that, knowing that so much good comes from hard times, and yet your kids are not experiencing these hard times? How can we curate? I've got my own opinions, but I'd like to hear from you. How can you curate adversity? How can you curate an environment for your kids to appreciate things, work hard, all of those things? I'd love to hear your opinion on that.
That is an absolutely poignant question that I have thought many times. Obviously, it's completely unethical and horrid to recreate those environments for your children. So how do you imbue the same lessons? And so what I've done, Jason, is I have told them the real stories. So whenever they're complaining about these little things, I'm like, I'm sorry, have you been beaten today? Did you have to inhale 2 packs of secondhand smoke indoors while you wondered where your next meal was going to come from? Like, I have no patience for your discontent or your anger. It is so ridiculous, I don't even know where to begin. And so I've said some things like that, and maybe psychologists wouldn't agree. And look, I have my psychology degree, and I graduated in the top 5% of my class. So, you know, I have some semblance of how I should behave as a parent, but I do have moments where I really lack patience.
Yeah.
And besides just using the words, and look, you know, I don't mind sharing that I had to do EMDR therapy for complex PTSD. So, you know, this isn't like putting me in the best light. But my kid said that, you know, Mom, I noticed that once you went through your treatment, you don't just, you know, sit in a room and cuss to yourself. I didn't realize I was doing that. And of course, I'm not going to do that on your show.
Right.
But I would just be sitting there and I'd be frustrated with something. Because you know how it is when you're running a business, you have a lot of staff. There's always someone, I don't care how well you hire, there's always someone who does something that just shocks you. And you're like, gee,
I get it.
Man, why can't people just do what the F they're supposed to do? Man, why, you know, I do what I'm supposed to do. I work hard. Why can't everybody else be like that, right? And so it's just a little cussing to myself like that. I don't do that anymore. I'm just much more calm. I don't have the same anger beneath the surface. So they've seen those kind of PTSD moments come out where they know that, you know, what I went through was real. And then I even took them around my family of origin. And they saw that, you know, children still get hit in that environment and for nothing. Okay. And they're like, my son's like, but I haven't taken them around them a lot, right? Just once or twice. And it's enough to create this contrast. And my son was like, Mom, what you said was real. Wow. Like that really did happen. Yes.
Right.
Unfortunately, it did. Other things we do are charity.
Yep.
Right? That's it.
So I was hoping you would say that, but yeah, it's a big one charity. For us. Yeah.
So we go to Northern California for, and let me tell you, Gavin Newsom has created a place ripe for recipients for charity. It is, look, I've been to Cuba and I've been to Northern California and they look eerily similar at this point.
Yeah.
It's disturbing, right. Truly disturbing. But the nature's beautiful out there. So we go out there for our vacations, long vacations, 2 or 3 months, hike in the redwoods, right? That's what we get to do now. Instead of the way I grew up, they're homeschooled and we get to go on these 2, 3, 4 month long road trips to these gorgeous places. And there are a lot of homeless people in Gavin Newsom's California. There are a lot of people on drugs. You can't even use a public bathroom out there because people will go in there and shoot up. So you got to make best friends with the gas station owner to get a key. And when you're road tripping, that becomes a very important negotiation skill set. So we can talk about real estate negotiation all we want. You can talk about a different kind of negotiation. Try to use a public bathroom on a road trip in California. And out there, we got involved in this church, and there was this schizophrenic man who would sit with us at the table at church because the church would feed anyone who'd come in off the street. So you get a lot of severely mentally ill people. And this one schizophrenic guy who was wearing a hero mask, you know, like he was there to do the work of a superhero in his mind. And he's like, he told my son, I'm trying to figure out which food I should eat in order to levitate. And my youngest son goes, well, probably need to eat the beans because it's going to give you propulsion power.
Perfect.
You know, so I learned that I tried to teach them we need to treat even the homeless and the extremely mentally ill as God's children. And so that's another way is they need to see that people live in quite an unfortunate way. There's not a lot of climate control in California. You know, you stay in different Airbnbs. Good luck finding a true central unit AC. In Texas, every house, I don't care how poor you are, has central unit AC.
Right.
Not in California, you know, and nor heaters even. And so it's crazy that we spent, you know, almost 3-4 months with no climate control, even in a business Airbnb and nice ones at that. So it's a totally different world out there. We're kind of lucky in Virginia and Texas. You guys have a lot of good infrastructure in Virginia. As you know, I spent a lot of time out there. I didn't really see many houses without central AC and heat and stuff.
Right.
But you don't have to go very far to really see a lot of places. If you're a charitable person, you want to stay in the United States and you're not in your own backyard, go to California. There's a lot of really hungry,
yeah,
sad, sad situations out there in a very beautiful and expensive place.
One thing that we, and it's hard as a parent because, like, instinctively, I want to make everything easy for my kids, right? That's, like, by nature, I'm the protector, I'm the provider. Let me do that. But my wife and I, we try to be very diligent about even little things, like things that you wouldn't think are a big deal, like, you know, making their lunch for the day or whatever it is, like, we just let them be independent and do everything on their own. And that's hard sometimes because what happens? They spill stuff. They drop stuff. They break stuff. They start yelling and screaming because they're frustrated. But I think it's important for them to work through all those failures and emotions, even on the small things, because as they become older, the small things are, they don't even think about them anymore. And now as they have real adversity, they kind of have some exposure of, okay, I've been disappointed before. I have failed before. And yeah, let me work through this. And it evolves as they get older. But I mean, even a lot of our closest friends that have kids and people that we're around, I mean, we're around a lot of other kids and families, but do everything for their children. And I who knows? I mean, I don't know where that's going to lead. But I feel like intuitively that's setting them up to not be able to handle any adversity, right? And I'm very disciplined about that with my kids. I want them to fail right in front of my face, you know. And that, I think, you know, that's the only way, and through activities that they're involved in. I mean, both of my kids are in various sports and activities and stuff like that. That we talked about wrestling with my son.
Yeah.
He got his butt kicked this past weekend, and good. Like, I want him to feel that, but it's in a controlled environment. He's not.
Control.
Yeah, he's not getting beat up on the streets. He's in a wrestling controlled environment. He's learning how to lose. He's learning humility. He's learning how to be a good teammate, a good student to coaches and all that. So I think it's important.
It is important. Well, yeah.
And we've spent the first 25 minutes here and haven't even introduced what your actual business is. So I want to get into that because a lot of our listeners are in real estate, both commercial and residential, and in various roles, wholesalers, realtors, you know, all along the every angle of or every niche of real estate. So take a moment to kind of explain what it is that you do in your business. And then I kind of want to get into how you got into that. I would love to hear that story as well.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it might make more sense to start with how it got started and what it turned into.
Perfect.
Once my youngest was able to go to daycare, which I didn't do until he was 3 years old, I was able to focus. So that time between 16 and 35 was from a lack, I don't want to say a lack of focus, because starting at age 25, I became a mother. And so I was home and I was a housewife, and that was very meaningful to me. I wanted to be home with my children.
The most important job you've ever done, I would imagine. Yeah, I mean, for sure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I feel like my sons respect me a lot from that time, because I had invested so much time into being with them all day, every day.
Yeah.
And I did go back to college in my late 20s to finish. So my oldest was put into a daycare, you know, so that I could finish college, but later on, right? So not full-time daycare or anything like that until they were both around 3 years old. So I finished college at 30 years old, graduated summa cum laude, 7 months pregnant, with like more awards and more medallions than anybody else. Because whenever you grow up the way we did, you are very, very motivated and very hungry. And so, you know, they're like, wow.
You got a little bit of you're working with a little bit of a chip on your shoulder too, I would imagine.
Yeah. Right. Well, the fear of going back to that place is extremely, it's one kind of motivation. It's probably not the best kind, but it's one kind.
Right.
And so I graduated, and then I gave birth. And so it was kind of like I'm starting all over again, being at home.
Right.
And so I really didn't get to focus on work until I was about 33 years old or so. And once I, it was, let's see here, it was the summer of 2018. So yeah, so I would have been 33. And I put my son into full-time daycare. And all of a sudden, all that success that I had been priming myself for and thinking about and wanting to do since I was 16 years old, I was kind of finally able to do that with the advent of the internet. A lot had changed from the time I became a housewife. So from 2010 to 2018, the world had changed a lot in terms of the ability to get online and really leverage a business. So a friend of mine invited me to do cold calling for a real estate investor. Now, at the time, I still had a five-month-old at the teat, and it was just something that I could do. I made $5 an hour. But as I gained experience cold calling with a baby at home, you know, but not too many hours, it at least gave me a niche that a friend of mine said, you know, Jen, out of everyone I know, you have the best ability to determine people's motivations. Now, that probably came from getting beaten almost every day and being around people who were crazy and on drugs. You didn't know what was coming, especially when you're a little girl. I mean, we're talking like 45 pounds at age 5 years old. You learn to get very smart and use your mouth to keep people away from you or take advantage of the situation, get some caregiving or whatever it is. It was either that or it was innately born or both. I think that people who are successful usually have a certain amount of talent. They have a certain amount of coaching and they become very experienced at the same time. I think it takes all three: talent, coaching, and putting in the reps.
I agree.
So they got me on the phones and they're like, wow, you really, at first I was bad because I was nervous, right? So don't feel like you have to start really, really good on the phones. It was like, wow, Jen, that was a really terrible call, but you graduated the top of your class, so I'm going to keep investing in you. And that turned out to work well. So that's where the coaching part came in, right? I had to give my, and I say this to my coaching students, you have to give yourself the grace and space to be terrified and terrible. You're not going to start out good no matter how talented you are. You have to give yourself the grace and space to be terrified and terrible.
At
So
everything in life is that way. So, I mean, yeah, that doesn't just apply to cold calling. So,
that's
yeah,
right.
for sure. Yeah.
And so I was able to push through that with coaching and reps. And then I became very good at it, so I'm told. And then I had way more clients than I could possibly service. And so Upwork, and I was, selling my labor through Upwork. And Upwork said, hey, we're going to do this beta testing on this agency type deal. Will you be a beta tester since you're such a highly rated freelancer? I said, yes. So in the fall of 2018, I started my agency. And at first, I just started with 10 Americans. And now I have 180 virtual assistants all around the world. But from that, okay, Jim Ingersoll, who's in your area, he saw from my postings how hard I worked and how many sellers I would speak to in any given day and the conversations I would have. And he said, Jennifer, you talk to sellers and negotiate and lead manage and get them to sign these purchase and sale agreements over the phone for half of their equity. I mean, that's no small thing, right? And it was a skill set built over about 15,000 calls with a few different coaches who really helped get me over those humps that I couldn't intuitively get over. Because not everything about negotiation is intuitive. You need some coaching. And so Jim Ingersoll said, Jen, you are on the phone with sellers more than anyone else that I know. Why don't you come to Virginia, to Richmond, and come speak at this event? It was funny, Jason, as I thought I was doing my friend a favor. I thought I was doing him a favor.
Yeah.
By
You
going to
were.
speak.
I'm sure you were. But, all right. Yeah.
But after I got done speaking on something that I thought all these real estate investors knew anyways, I'm like, why is he having me come and speak on something that all these investors already knew anyways? How can you be a real estate investor and not know how to, reach out to sellers off market and negotiate and, figure out if they really want to sell or not? Why is he having me teach this stuff that everybody knows? Well, it turns out maybe only 10% of the room actually was doing that, at most. And the other 90%, real estate investors, what? They rely on others to get them deals? What? No way. I couldn't believe that. It just didn't compute to me. But I couldn't get to the bathroom for 2 hours, Jason. I really needed to use the restroom after I got done off stage. And
Yeah.
I could not because all, I mean, it was a couple hundred people maybe I spoke in front of.
Was that your first time? I know you spent a lot of time on the phone. Was that your
Yeah.
first time in person in front of a big group like that?
For that business, yes. In college, I would have to, because I was a nerd, despite a rough background, I'm hugely, hugely intellectual, which sounds like a douchey thing to say, but I mean, it's just a fact.
Right.
And so I was very academically gifted my whole life. And so they would have me give presentations on either the research I was contributing to or maybe my own research project, right, at the collegiate level. And I would have to give these presentations and then I get graded on that. And then of course I had communications class and I was in theater in high school, which was no small thing because I mean my high school had like 2,000 people in it and everyone would come and see your show. And so I had been on stage in front of people, but Jason, it was either something I was doing in a group, like no one does research by themselves, right? I mean
Right.
it's a group. So it was like I might have been the one presenting it, but I had a big team behind me. Or, in theater, you're pretending to be someone else, which is fun. Everyone likes to escape the inside of their own minds, right? And so that's one way to do it. But it was the first time anyone had ever valued me outside of school for my brain. Now, I'm older now, but at one point, the only thing the world seemed to value about me was my appearance. And I told Jim Ingersoll that this was the first time in my life outside of school where I felt like anyone valued my brain. And that was huge for my self-esteem. So to get in front of an audience where everybody in the room just about had at least, maybe a $5 to $10 million net worth, which I know that's not like a ton, especially with inflation on properties, but it was way more than I had grown up with, and it was they were way more well-to-do than anyone in my neighborhood, even still, right? I mean, I still live in the same house that I bought when I was in my early 30s in a very lower middle class neighborhood. And so no matter how much money I made, Jason, I've stayed in the same house
Right.
because I learned the lessons of the cash flow game. I know that freedom, and my neighbors are great. I mean, pastors, cops, librarians, I mean, those are middle class folks. But great, I mean, you can ask for better neighbors than cops, librarians, and pastors. So
Right.
there's no point in moving.
A lot of places there.
Never replicate that level of neighbor. And so it was huge to have this conversation about what I do with my brain and my business, not in a team, not in a standing on the shoulders of giants thing with research, and not pretending to be someone else in a theater in a theatrical fashion. I'm having to add value to people. And let's be honest, these RIAs, a lot of them, at least if they're high quality, you're getting maybe 80% people with white hair, gray hair, and no hair. So I feel like quite the young buck
I'm in the no
standing
hair
here.
camp. Not quite gray, but no hair for sure.
Well,
But
then you're 50% of the way there. When you
there
have
you
no hair and white hair, then you're usually on top of your game,
go.
and you're the bank at that point, right? You're not out here hustling for deals.
Right.
You're the bank. So I wasn't the bank. I was hustling for deals. And so it was more than intimidating, to say the least. I'd had 3 hours of sleep and I couldn't sleep. And so I'm up there in front of all these people trying to do my best on 3 hours of sleep. And whenever I was done, I got this, like I said, the standing ovation, and everybody was so excited to talk to me. And I couldn't believe it, because I was just a humble acquisitions manager. I didn't plan on having a platform. Nobody knew who I was until, Jim had put me on stage. And that opened up all these opportunities. All of a sudden, I had a wholesale data source, right? So one of the things that my company does is we do data and skip tracing. We like to be a wholesale source for wholesalers. So for that, I don't even have a website. You just have to email me at jen@reidatasource.net. And the reason why is because it keeps my overhead low. I don't do a ton of marketing. I don't have a website. You just tell me what you need, what orders, and we pull it for you, right? If you need data plus skip tracing, it's 3 cents. If you need just skip tracing alone, it's 2 cents. And if we had to do a lot of marketing and have a big fancy website, I'd have to charge more, because then I'd have to justify the cost of the website, which means I'd have to do a lot of marketing. And so anyway, so a lot of people white label my data. I have three different white label partners. They have big platforms. So I'm always looking for white label partners. I prefer not to be the person in front of, the business face. I like to be the person ideally behind the scenes that is supplying the front men. Right? Because I've done my time. I feel like I've done my time at this point. I'm happy to go and speak. I'm happy to, be the, I'm, I will be the front man, but it's a much sweeter spot to just have people doing that hustling, and I'm just supplying it to their audience, right? So being in that room allowed me to people introduce me, like, hey, well, if you're doing all these cold calls, and that means you must need a lot of data. I'm like, yeah, I have all the staff and we do a ton of calling. Great. So can you sell my data? I said, I don't know if anyone cares about that. I mean, I don't know if they care. He's like, well, just do a test, just make a post. And I had an overwhelming amount of response for that. And then also being in the room and speaking gave me the opportunity to be a commercial loan broker. People are like, hey, if you have this huge platform of all these investors, then you're going to need someone to do loans too. Will you broker my loans for me? So yeah, so I broker both commercial and residential loans. And then of course we still have all of our cold callers and lead managers. And then I have my license with EXP, the referral division, for one reason only. Well, one main reason only, and that is to refer deals two realtors in my market and markets across the United States. So let's say I have a client in Boise, Idaho, and they're a flipper. And of course, you know, we're going to run across a lot of leads who want to sell on the retail market. And so what I do is I just refer that lead to the particular realtor in that area and get a 25% GCI. And so that, you know, those are all the ways that all the businesses cross-pollinate, to where really the short version is I specialize in both finding and funding deals, commercial and residential.
So you it's a lot to unpack there. And you mentioned you have now, you've scaled that to roughly 180 employees across, you know, all your services. Logistically, what does that look like? Do you have direct management of 180 employees, or are they groups of, like, do you have a supervisor that oversees 20 in this particular area? How are you structured in that way?
Well, here's maybe where the complex PTSD shows. I hired them one-on-one and I managed them one-on-one. But I'm a very strict and low-tempered task manager in a way. So I hire people who suit my temperament and my temperament suits them. So I hire people who, like your children, like the way you've set them up, are independent. Mm-hmm. So in the past, I had group meetings and I had group managers. Guess what happened? Well, they organized against me.
Right. Okay. Right.
They organized against me and I let them all go. I was like, you know what? I will replace all of you, and adios and vaya con Dios. Unlike you guys, I have a ton of savings and I have passive income. So sorry about your bad luck, right? So when
I'm with you. Yeah.
So what I learned was, do not let them group. Don't let them know who the other is. Don't let them have any real key people between them. So what I did was I hired them all individually and I managed them all individually, but I choose people who are self-starters. I give them an environment that captures the people who want the kind of freedom that you and I want. And so that took a lot of kissing a lot of frogs, right? But here's the best way that I found. Now, you don't let anyone really know too many people, but it's unavoidable for them to know more than, I mean, some of the people are going to know each other because the way that I hire, right? So in order to work for me, you have to be the friend or acquaintance of someone who's already successful, right? But you just can't let...
Successful within your organization.
Yes, but you can't let too many of them cluster, because that's whenever they organize. But most people don't know a huge amount of really successful people who are going to do a great job in that role.
Right.
So that limits your liability there. And so by meeting these people who are self-starters, who are happy to have a constant supply of clients, who show up, and look, I haven't even had to hire anyone new in a good while. It's been a while. I'm just now interviewing someone, I think, today, and it would be my first new hire in a year, just because I've had an expansion of clients recently. And he's comes very well recommended, and he's fluent in both Spanish and English with almost no accent, which is amazing. And so that's how I built it out, was one by one. And I did used to have managers, but then they realized, you know, and this is what, at least they realized how much power they had. I feel like if we did the same thing with our government, we'd be pretty formidable.
Right. We're going to have a whole nother hour on that topic.
That's so, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, look, I don't want to come across as a tyrant, but it wasn't necessarily in their best interest, because my clients couldn't afford the things that they were wanting. They wanted, you know, higher hourly wages, even though I'm already paying them double market. That's why I shut it down. It's not like they were asking for something reasonable, Jason. It was because I was already paying them literally double market. I mean, I charge $13.50 an hour for my virtual assistants. My profit on that is 5%. My real money comes from my loans being transparent, right? Just like what you and I talked about. The real power is having a platform and in being the bank. If you can be the bank and build a platform, you're going to be the most powerful person you can possibly be. And so really, my profit margin on the cold callers is very small. And they still wanted more money. And I was like, guys, you're being absolutely ridiculous. You already get paid double market. And so that's what I mean is, I'm sure the government feels this way about us, but sometimes what the people want is not in their best interest. Because in my case, the market couldn't bear it. I mean, the market could barely bear it as it is at double market rate, but I do only hire the best people. We're talking about upper middle class people. People with master's degrees and people who, one of them's been to law school, Six Sigma certified. And so we're talking about upper middle class folks who want to make this their career overseas and the United States. And so that's what happened. So that's the reason why I manage them one on one, because otherwise I would either A, look like an amateur or B, insane. But
Are
that was
they,
just the way I
are
adapted.
they, I'm just, I'm still hung up on the logistics piece of it because, like, I'm thinking in my former career, I managed pretty big teams, but
Yes.
I always only directly managed no more than 20 people. But that was a day-to-day management type situation, right? It sounds like what you're describing, you have a team of 180, but it's very, you don't, it doesn't, if you've hired the right people the way you are hiring them, it doesn't require a daily management of their task and stuff. I would imagine you're having, every so often meetings with them to go over metrics and things like that that y'all are tracking. But outside of that, they're not, there's not a back and forth with 180 people every day, right?
Right. So they'll send me an end of day report every day so that I can see how many calls they made, how long they work. And look, I don't want to be crass, but that's toilet activities, right? Just sit on the toilet and just
That's
my
my little,
toilet paper are the KPIs, right? Like, okay, well, Monique sent that she did, 8 hours of call stay. Here's the amount of leads. And then every time they send a lead or an appointment or a contract, they put it into either the WhatsApp group or Upwork, however they get contracted, wherever the client comes from. And I see how many calls they've made that day, and then they will post a recording of the call with that person. And then I just glance at it. No news is good news, right? Brevity is how you're going to keep your time and your sanity. The only way I hear from them or they hear from me is if there's a problem, right? Okay, well this client needs this. Okay, boom, got it. Here's the person to do that, right? And so I have probably 30 of those waiting for me, but they take about a 60 seconds a piece. Right. So, my husband drives me because I have a broken ankle, and well, this was a little piece broken. The ligament came off and took a piece of the
No.
bone with it.
To be
So
clear, this, to everybody listening, this is very temporarily. Her husband doesn't drive her every day, all year. Just book back now. So.
Well, I drive myself to the gym and back,
Yeah,
but yeah,
there you
he
go.
makes sure I can continue to do business instead of,
Right.
I don't waste time driving or cooking or cleaning or stuff like that. He make sure all that's taken care of. So,
Good, good.
I'll look at their KPIs and I'll look at it and make sure it's good, or I send them clients. So I still do the client intake. I like having those conversations. And whenever people come to me, I learn about their business. I learn about, can we help them? Not everyone we can help. Not everyone needs help. And, not everyone can afford our prices. So it's not like we can help everybody, but I like doing the client intake. I enjoy that. I enjoy speaking with other entrepreneurs. So then me, in my head, I have 180 people Rolodex in my head, and I'm thinking, okay, based on this person's personality, this person's needs. For example, if someone wants them to do CRM cleanup, dispo, as well as acquisitions calls, I'm not going to put my acquisition specialist who only want to do acquisitions on that person's team. Because they're just going to kick me like a mule the whole time. Oh, Jen, I just want to do acquisition. Nope, I know that I have other people who are more versatile that I need to put on that campaign. Or if someone comes to me and they're like, we really just need someone to clean up our CRM or organize our data. Okay, I've got someone for that. Okay, I need someone who just specializes in dispo and needs to get these dispo contracts under contract. Okay, I've got someone for that. So I just keep it memorized somehow. Because I think the human brain is used to living in a village, I understand, from an evolutionary standpoint of about 150 people,
Right.
and that we really can't keep up with more than 150 people at one time. And so they're kind of like my village, like
Right.
I just have them all memorized and who all's in there. And of course, my children too. My oldest son is on WhatsApp, and my most important people, my most reliable and my best, they're friends with him on WhatsApp. I do have team leaders for my data and skip tracing. I do not talk to all of those staff, to your point, because those teams came to me. I didn't create those teams.
Right.
Right. And so those people are managed. And so my son is also friends with the team leaders on WhatsApp. So that all of this is heritable. And because he homeschools, he's done it about noon. And so he's able to kind of sit in with me, meet the same people, meet my staff. They know my son.
You're setting up a little monster here. I mean, if he's 13 getting these reps in at that age.
Yeah, he's 14 and he's 6'1", and everyone says he looks like Barron Trump. And so he is very precocious. And like, I used to go to these PhD dissertations when he was 5 and I was still in college. I would bring him with me and they would be like, why is this lady bringing in this 5-year-old to this PhD dissertation that this person's worked God knows how many years on? And people would just look at me like, who is this insane person?
Yeah.
But he would just sit there and pay attention during the PhD dissertation, ask questions at the end. Well, you know, what is a yield curve and what is this and what is that? And
so good. You're hitting on like something that is so important to me. I intentionally, because I'm with my kids all the time, and I intentionally have some of my most important phone calls or Zoom calls with them sitting either in the back seat or because they're not understanding everything, but they over time the reps of just being grounded, it'll be intuitive to them. I think like
exactly.
I read Tiger Woods' biography several years ago, but his dad was talking about and. Tiger has made like some bad personal choices, but he's the best golfer ever. But his dad, from the time he was an infant, set him in a high chair and while he was at the driving range, and his dad would just hit golf balls over and over and over. So Tiger couldn't even hold a club at that point, but he was around it. He saw the reps. And to your point earlier, like you do that enough with your 14-year-old and your younger child and my kids, they're going to pick up on this. And when they start having to apply it, it's going to come so much quicker than folks that are just starting out, you know. And I think you're hitting on a really good point there.
It'll make the imposter syndrome less, because you know I struggle with imposter syndrome big time, and I noticed that I'll self-sabotage.
Yeah.
And the self-sabotaging will cost you so much time. What you said earlier, you don't waste time. My biggest and only regret as I turned 40 about a month ago was realizing how much time I wasted on spending money on material goods that didn't move the needle towards my happiness or long-term equity prospects and caring what people thought.
Yeah.
Those were my two biggest mistakes. Because I had imposter syndrome, I looked for validation from the industry titans.
Yep. I would argue though that like in hindsight, yes, because I am very guarded with my time, but there have been times, especially when I was younger, where I wasted time with mind-numbing activities. I'd sit down and watch ESPN for hours when, you know, it's like I'm not gaining anything from that other than entertainment, things like that. But you're saying that, like, that was a regret. I guarantee you doing that and has shaped you into who you are now, because you've got to go through doing stuff that you look back on and say, God, that was stupid. But you have to go through it, right? Because otherwise you would never know it. You'd never appreciate the time and the focus on the right thing. So I think
you may be right there.
Yeah. I mean, I think so, like the imposter syndrome. That's why I asked you earlier about getting on stage. And like, had you ever done that before? You know, I was kind of, and you answered it very eloquently, but like, how did you feel getting up in front of all these white haired folks that, you know, were so experienced, so wealthy, a lot of them, and you're going up there as an authority, very young, and finally getting to share with people your brain, right? That was exciting, but then get validated on the back end of that. That had to be a thrill, and it sounds like it catapulted everything else that came.
It changed my life completely. I mean, I may have been someone that nobody ever knew my entire life, where I just led a life of silent desperation as I tried to live out the values that I learned in Rich Dad, Poor Dad in the year 2000 and never quite got the traction. I mean, how horribly sad would that have been? I mean, at least I would have been a good mother who loved her children and, you know, provided a happy and safe and loving home, which is the best thing I feel like anyone can do. I mean, we all know who Mao Zedong is, but I doubt he was a great father. And so, if less of us wanted to rule the world and more people wanted to be great parents, I feel like this world would be a much better place. So, there's nothing wrong with living an obscure and peaceful life. In fact, that's what I'm working towards purposefully.
Yeah,
It's living
no,
an obscure and peaceful life, but I want to do it in a way where I don't have to worry about money. Right. And so that's the thing. Some people, they want to make money and be the most powerful person or the most important person. I want to be the most free and the most peaceful. And maybe that comes from my background, right? Kind of like Katniss Everdeen and the Hunger Games. Like, you know, she could have grabbed the political reins and she could have been someone politically. No, she just wanted to have a quiet and peaceful life after you've been through some real stuff. You know, that's how I feel, is I just want a quiet and peaceful life and help others get there as well. I don't want to just pull up the ladder and disappear completely into obscurity, right? I mean, I've helped a few dozen people be able to quit their day job and stay out of it. And that is absolutely meaningful to me that my staff and I can help provide that to people who are looking for that. And for people who already have it, hopefully do it in a more cost-effective way, whether it's the cost of money or the cost of the data and the skip tracing. Or even though my VAs are not cheap, they're so reliable that it makes it a passive income, right? So you can get cheap VA callers for $4 or $5 an hour, but I promise you're buying a job with those people. Whereas with my people, they've been vetted and they show up every day without excuse. They do an excellent job and you can count on them year after year. And so it makes it a passive business for me as well as a passive business for my clients because you can count on them to show up.
So what I'm going to encourage the listeners to do that are interested in your services, which, like I said, a lot of my folks are in real estate. They are in the business of finding deals and being organized in that, and most of them fail in that, right? So, I mean, not fail, but they aren't as efficient and effective as they could be otherwise, or using a
Yeah, we need
service has
help.
tours, right?
We all need help.
So we're gonna drop like your social media, and you mentioned it. You don't have a website. You don't need a website. We're going to drop your email address and your social media links and any other links that you want to share with us so folks can reach out and learn more about that. But where I want to take this now as we kind of wrap things up is you very in a very humble way talked to, you're a, for lack of a better term, rags to riches story, right? You came from humble beginnings. Now you're living out this vision of really doing life on your own terms. You could make a, you probably could yank that lever and go all in on this thing and make three times as much money as you do, but you're very calculated at balancing growth and the family and the calm that you're seeking in life. So I want you to speak a little bit on your health, how you manage your business that is, I mean, you spoke about it very humbly, but I know you have a lot of stuff going on in your business. It's very busy, right? You do a lot of things for a lot of people. How do you balance that with being a present mother, a present wife, and a fit and healthy human being?
I have a personal trainer, which sounds a little bit bougie, but he is kind enough to, you know, basically sell me his labor at economies of scale in terms of price. I've had the same trainer for 5 years, and with my injury, I'll be seeing him for the first time tomorrow in 3 weeks, just
Okay,
due
good.
Upper body. So that's exciting. So I do have a personal trainer, which forces me. It's not like I don't know how to do the workouts at this point. It's because even coaches need coaches, even trainers
Accountability.
need trainers. It helps me to have the accountability. And of course, he also helps me with form as well, because by ourselves, our form slip. I still go to acquisitions training with Jerry Green every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Central Standard Time. Even though I have plenty of my own experience, Jerry's been doing it since the 90s, and so Jerry is the absolute man. I want to give him a, you know, a quick shout out because coaches need coaches. And so I have a personal trainer. I also have, since my injury, which was just 3 weeks ago today, I have an elliptical. It's a recumbent elliptical. And so in the morning, I like to start my day with 1 hour of that. And I watch Bob Ross because it's very calming. He and I both love nature, and it turns out Amazon Prime has a 24/7 Bob Ross channel. So,
That's gold right there. I love it.
we'll watch that. Or, believe it or not, as odd as this may sound, I have my children in the room, and we watch Mr. Rogers, because even though it's geared toward younger children, the lessons about self-love, value, valuing your fellow human being, respect, staying curious about the little things in life, you know, how crayons are made, how erasers are made, and just that mindfulness. So we'll watch that. So, you know, and obviously I was a kid in the 80s, so some of those
Right.
things have held some influence. So I'll do that while I ride the exercise bike. And so if you notice, I double up. So you ask how I stay a present mom. While I'm doing my exercises in the morning in my room, I have my sons join me. So they are, you know, doing smaller weights. We have a portable treadmill that you can just kind of move quickly. It's just a simple, you can walk on it. I wouldn't
Yeah.
run on it. It doesn't have any handrails. And so they can move that in there. So we can be working out together. We have dinner together every day with lighted candles every single day. And we discuss the day. And otherwise, I don't see them much during the day, to be honest. But one thing I did provide was Daryl and I have taken turns over the years. So he paid all the bills while the children were little, because I believe that young children need their mothers. And so that's another thing I'm passionate about, is giving women the ability and men to work from home and care for their children while their children are little and really need them the most. So since Daryl allowed me to stay home, now that the children are older, I retired him. So he stays home and he takes care of them and he helps me. He's an amazing cook, okay? He's like chef level amazing cook. All organic ingredients, just fantastic. So he makes all of our meals 3 times a day. And you talk about how to be a good wife. You know, he met me at 16, like I said, reading the cash flow quadrant book. So he knew that
Knew
he
that
was
didn't.
getting with somebody where, you know, we were going to become wealthy and be, you know, useful members of the community. Like that was going to be the deal, right? And he's the only man I've ever been around where I felt like he somehow saw my business side as well as my mom side. And also still like to because whenever you meet and you're that young, you stay young forever. So whenever we're together and we're alone, instead of being our pardon my language, our old asses together, 40 and 45, we're 16 and 21 again. Anytime we're alone, you know, we're telling jokes, we're laughing, we're having fun. And look, you talk about intimacy. These last 3 weeks, I couldn't toilet by myself. I needed help getting to the toilet. He's
Right.
had to bathe me. And so we joke. It's like, okay, it's bathe the cripple time or
Yeah.
time to give grandma a sponge bath. Come on, sweetheart. While he, you know, gets the shower chair and takes my boot off. I mean, that's rough stuff. And he didn't complain. He didn't, you know, make me feel less than or weird or gross. And he just showed up. And so we show up for each other. We also give each other a lot of space. I don't micromanage what he does in his private time, and he doesn't micromanage what I do, because we know that a certain amount of privacy is necessary for sanity and health. We also trust each other.
That's
You know, we
important.
both know that the other is not going to do something that's going to jeopardize the family unit. And guess what? Do you think we've been perfect for 23 years? Do you think we haven't had moments where someone didn't do something that didn't jeopardize the family unit or was selfish? But you know what we did in those situations? We forgave each other. We communicated about it. It's not like it was easy. It's not like there weren't fights. It's not like there weren't some nasty knockdown drag-out moments.
Right.
But we moved past it because we shared the same vision. His parents were married a total of 8 times apiece, and so were mine. So we have 16 marriages between both of our parents.
Wow.
And we knew, because we both grew up similarly, although he had less, I would say he had different stuff. And obviously, I would never speak to his stuff because it's not my place. But I will say that although his stuff was different from mine, what we had in common was the fact that no matter what, we wanted to make sure that our children had present parents who loved them.
Yeah.
And so even times whenever we hated each other, we couldn't stand each other. And you thought, you know, I thought I could do better. And he thought he could do better just by being completely by himself in the woods in a van down by the river, you know, which I feel like every man fantasizes at some point. Like, I just want to leave the wife, the kids, and live in a van down by the river. And the wife thinks, well, you know, maybe I could be with someone who's a little bit more romantic or maybe makes more money. And these are thoughts that women have, right? Men don't really think that they could maybe do better in a wife in general, but they just want to be left alone for the love of God. You know, just leave me alone. And a woman's like, I want a guy who, you know, maybe brings me flowers. But that's not really what matters. What really matters is, do you show up for each other every day? Do you complete the tasks at hand? Do you show each other respect, right? Respect, logistics. I know that sounds crazy, but, you know, marriage should not be based on how attractive the other person is. Although I do believe there should be chemistry. You're going to have a really long,
100%.
Unsatisfying life, you know? So chemistry, respect, and logistics. Are they going to show up for you every day? Are you going to show up for them?
Spaces, you touched on it earlier, but space is a big one too. Just and that comes with trust, right? And that's my wife, we're coming up on 17 years.
That's
think
great.
About it for a second, but that has been, those are, you've nailed a few of them, but the trust and just communication, like sometimes,
yes.
You know, there's just never any doubts about anything, right? We just openly
right.
talk about it all, but then there's this level of trust, and just over the years, you get this understanding of when, like, I know when my wife just needs some space and just needs to go sit down and scroll through reels and doesn't need me nagging her about anything. I know that, you know, and she knows that about me when I need to go play golf or just get out for a little bit. And so I think that it, but also, it is important, the chemistry and the passion and all that, to be there too. And that takes work. Like that can fizzle out, and it does fizzle out in a lot of relationships over time because everything else just kind of gets in the way. But yeah.
We're assuming children are little. So that's where that 7-year itch came in, and the pain of not sleeping through the night for years and years and years. But for anyone who's young and in that space, and you're going through that space of young children, you feel like you can't stand each other and divorce is the only solution. We're on the other side of that now, and we've come through that, because we did. We actually did get a divorce, and then he came back during COVID, right? So, you know, if you just, like all the sociologists say, if you just stick through the crappy time of your kids being little and being poor, I mean, that's a rough combination, having small children and being poor, and it broke us,
right.
No pun intended, right? I mean, it did. It just broke us. But if you just stick through that horrible time of being poor with small kids, now we are so happy because our kids are older and I have money. Guys, just get real.
Right.
Just get real. When your kids are older and you have money, people say when you have money, you discover who you really are. And it turns out I am a happy, free-loving, not in the old hippie sense of the word, but, you know, loving upon everyone I come around. I'm just happy to see everybody. I like everybody when my stress is low, right? And so if you can just come through that time and let your children get older and give your time for your wealth and your money to build, you know, we have so much fun now. I mean, going on those long road trips, 3-4 months with the kids,
awesome.
And hiking and just hanging on the beach and holding hands. Now, just like whenever you make money, after all those years of hard work, you don't feel the money. It's not like winning the lotto. It's not like, woohoo, all this money. You know, you don't feel this giddiness because it just came out from nothing. When you've worked for something, the giddiness is not there. But the contentment, contentment and joyfulness. So we worked so hard that we don't sit on the beach holding hands with butterflies. We sit on the beach holding hands like people who've been through war.
Right.
Together. And I don't mean to use that term lightly because I'm not a veteran. So please pardon the expression. I don't mean to be disrespectful. But in my imagination, that's about the equivalent of holding hands on the beach after, you know, 22 years together and having gone through all the poverty, the children and everything else. Right. And
well, Jen, so, it's, guys, it's a, it's a good story. I think I'm gonna kind of summarize a few key notes that I made that I really think that are transferable to anybody listening, right? So number one is, like, you've built to where you are through obviously grit to get through a really difficult childhood, right? You know, I'm sure we could probably spend an hour sharing stories about our childhood that could be a separate podcast, but I know just from what you told me, that was not easy, right? So you build this person that comes through all of that, and then you want something. You have this idea, but you didn't know how to get it. And so you have the intelligence, you have the idea, probably have the creativity, but then life starts happening, right? And that happens to most people. And then the babies start coming, and then years go by. But it sounds like when you locked in with this idea of, I need to surround myself with people that can teach me, I need to put the freaking reps in. And that's the thing that I get. I'll go back to it. I said it earlier, but most people get lost in this idea of, oh, you mean I actually have to work and I have to, this ain't going to happen overnight, right? And you see, you don't have to look very far online to see in social media, these people that are having, they seem to be so successful. And if they're having true success, you know, people might say, oh man, it must be nice, it happened overnight. No, most of it, yours didn't happen overnight. My success hasn't happened overnight. Right. I'm not putting out all the hard stuff on social media, nor was it around when I was going through all that. But, you know, that doesn't get seen. And so people just see the highlight reels most of the time and think when they put 6 months, a year into trying something and it's not succeeding and they're not getting that hockey stick growth, that, oh, this isn't for me. It is for you. Just keep putting consistency in action is the only thing that succeeds over time, right? Long term. I mean, that's the only sustainable thing. And you are living proof of that. You just shared your age, so I'll reference back to it, but you're 40 years old and you are, in your definition and mine too, from what I'm hearing, you are financially free, right? You've built something that can sustain a lifestyle. So now you get to live out the rest of your life as long as you can sustain these streams of income passively and some, you know, actively, but you get to live the rest of your life, your children's watching them grow old, making them a part of the business if they choose to be. You do it under your terms, and now you get to impact people even more so than you have. And I think that's a great story that folks should and will get inspired by, and I appreciate you sharing it. So
thank you, Jason. Thanks for pointing out that it did take 20 years.
Right.
I mean, you know, 15 to 35 was just, I did not hit the success that I wanted despite my best efforts. And it took 20 years. I'm hopefully I can shorten someone's curve today with some things that I've shared. But if you have been trying for 20 years, then keep at it.
Yeah. And one more thing, I just, in that summary, I want to be very clear on this. You were bold and you were fearless because you got invited. I mean, you talked about the Dealmaker event, the gym invited you to. You were invited to that and you didn't say no out of fear. You said, yeah, I'll do it. I'm brave enough to go up there and do it. And look what happened because you took that step. How many people get invited or asked to be a part of something and they choose not to because of fear, or they have of the fear they have or the anxiety? And they miss out on what could be a literal life-changing event for you. All you had to do was say, no, I'm good. I don't want to do it. And you might still be struggling trying to build something. But
that's right. And I only slept 3 hours the night before. So the anxiety was there. I had to walk. There's video footage of me doing that speech. And I had to walk to force the blood back up to my brain. Because I was blacking out from how nervous I was. People were like, oh, you're so engaging. You walked around the audience. What I couldn't tell them was I was walking because I needed to force the blood back up to my brain. So I was starting to black out.
I heard flop. No, that is funny. So, but Jen, I appreciate it. I've followed you for a while. And you are, I appreciate you getting vulnerable with your story. You know, I'm sure you mostly are talking about the nuts and bolts of your business when you go on these types of podcast. So I kind of wanted to kind of peel the onion back a little bit and let folks see who, what's really there and the story behind it and stuff like that. And then those that are interested in what you're doing in business, obviously they can reach out and hopefully build something with you. So with that, I can't thank you enough. If you've got anything else you'd like to leave the folks with, you can do that now.
I would say whatever your vision is in your mind. So I think deep down, we all have a feeling for the way our world should be and should look. Don't ignore that. Grab onto it with both hands and work towards it until you have it. And you will be much more content. Things will feel right. They'll feel like they're in their right place. Don't compromise on that. It doesn't mean don't take a detour. It doesn't mean don't do things you don't want to do until you get there. It means don't just sit down and give up. You sit down and think, but never sit down and give up. Keep that thought of what your life should look like in your mind at all times. And don't give up.
Boom. I love it. I got nothing to add there. So, Jennifer, I appreciate you. And thank you for joining us on Burning the Ships.
Thank you, Jason. Great podcast name. Thank you.
I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. Jennifer is clearly a powerhouse in the real estate industry. And like most of these episodes and interviews, I don't come into them with anything scripted. And a lot of times we end up talking about life and family and fitness and all kinds of other stuff. So Jennifer, you know, if you're in the real estate world or looking into getting into it or looking to ramp up your acquisitions, you know, she's a good resource for that. And she's a connector. She's connected with pretty much everybody or somebody in every niche of real estate. She's also, as she talked about, doing some lending as well now. And I just think, you know, we didn't get into too in-depth with her business, because we were talking so much about other topics. But I encourage all of you to, if you're not already, go follow along Jennifer's journey. And, you know, we'll put her social media links and everything in the show notes for you guys to check her out. But, I mean, she is a, her story is just, it's funny because I do these episodes, you know, a couple episodes a week recording them. And I get to talk to a lot of people that have interesting stories. They have their unique paths and that they've taken in business or life or whatever the case may be. But her story is so interesting because you could clearly, as she spoke about it, she had this bug and this mindset at a very early age. I mean, at 15 years old, she's reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I didn't read it until I was 37 years old, 36, something like that. Wasn't even on my radar. So she was thinking this way, and then life happens, right? Life throws curveballs and takes you down paths that you don't expect. And, you know, she told her story so eloquently, but it's inspiring to that, really, to paint the picture that if you want something bad enough and you're passionate enough, but you also have the grit and the wisdom and the hunger and the pain or whatever the case may be to get to where you envision yourself going, you can make it happen. Jennifer's a great example of that. And we've talked to many others as well that have done the same thing. So with that, that'll wrap up another episode of Burning the Ships. I appreciate you guys joining us. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Burning the Ships. I want to give a special thanks to our sponsor, 608B Capital, helping real estate investors secure fast, reliable funding to fuel their boldest moves. If you're ready to take your investing to the next level, visit 608bcapital.com to learn more. If you found value in today's episode, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast. Your feedback not only helps us improve, but it also helps us reach more people who are ready to burn the ships and commit fully to their goals. And don't forget to share the episode with someone who needs that extra push to take bold action. I'll leave you with this. Burning the ships isn't just about removing the option to retreat. It's about unlocking the courage to charge forward. No matter the odds, the past is behind you and the future is yours to conquer. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time on Burning the Ships.